Thank you for joining us today for another sermon podcast from Flushing Community Church. We desire to experience the transforming love of God and share it with others. It's our hope that you will find today's recording encouraging for your personal journey of faith. Let's join a member of our staff as they share another message from God's Word.
Ladies and gents, this is the moment you've waited for, right? That's the only time you're going to hear me sing, unless I'm sitting in back of you, and then you'll hear me sing. Well, we are in week three of a series we're calling At the Movies. It's where we look at some movies and get to have some spiritual conversation, and we get to gain some spiritual wisdom and insight from some movies. And so it's really a great series, and today we are looking at one of my favorite all-time movies, The Greatest Showman. Now, in a second, I'm just going to ask you how many of you have either seen this movie, or if you're like me, before you saw the movie, you were singing the songs to this soundtrack way before you've seen the movie. So quite a few of you have seen this, or maybe even singing the songs of this. Really, it was an amazing movie. Where else do you get to hear Wolverine sing, right? Right? But it was great. Hugh Jackman did a great job in this movie. This movie is based loosely on the life of Phineas Taylor Barnum, or P.T. Barnum, who in 1871 created what would be known as the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And sadly, this circus shut down a few years ago. And now to say it's loosely based, some would say that would be a bit of a stretch, because really a lot of the story of his story has been reimagined or reinvented for the movie. However, it's a beautiful, it's a compelling story, but it is important to know this. The movie is primarily the work of fiction, okay? It's the work of fiction. It does not follow his story to a T. Only very few details are pulled out of that. And so if you have a YouVersion, you can log on that way. There is no insert for you to follow along, so lucky you get to look at beautiful me. If you want to check in and use any of our hashtags and engage in social media, you can do that as well. And so we ask you to engage that way this morning as we dive in to this movie series and talk about The Greatest Showman. So the movie begins with Phineas, the boy, who's living in poverty with his father. And as all good tales go, there's a tragedy in the boy's life, and he must find a way to live in this cruel world to those who are born in the lower class. Thanks to the kindness of a woman who has some sort of unknown condition, she gives the boy an apple. She gives Phineas the boy an apple, which inspires Phineas the man to create this new show, this circus, as you will, displaying all sorts of odd people. People that are not normal. People that are not usual. A bearded lady, a giant, a wolf man, Siamese twins, a man tattooed to head to toe, limb to limb. This circus, though, has its opponents, those who fear the unknown, the unusual. Phineas must fight against so many cultural norms to create a home for his own family, but to also create a place for these people of the circus. Despite his success, he cannot escape the lower class to which he was born in. The deformed, the strange, the human oddities, the people he befriended, they're a result, or thought to be a result, of moral depravity. So the righteous protest the circus, along with the people who fear they don't understand. But there are two constant aspects throughout the movie of Phineas's life. They're this: he loves his wife and his children without reserve, and he cares deeply for the friends that he has at the circus. Now, of course, there wouldn't be a story without watching if there wasn't a hiccup every now and again at how Phineas treats his family and treats these friends of the circus. But it's evident that he cares not for what society deems as acceptable, but no, he loves regardless of what's right. Now, it's not hard to see biblically how we could go with this story. But unlike Phineas Taylor Barnum, I'm not going to go the typical way you may think. So today, I want us to look at this movie, The Greatest Showman, through the lens of this idea. You can't serve two masters. You can't serve two masters. That's this lens that we're going to look at The Greatest Showman today. And in Luke 16, verses 1 through 16, Jesus tells a parable of a shrewd manager. Now we're going to go through this parable a couple lines at a time, and then we're going to explain the verses at a time. And so this is the lens that we're looking at The Greatest Showman. So if you can take off your soundtrack, your singing Greatest Showman soundtrack, the lens that you normally see The Greatest Showman through or sing through, just take that off, because we're going to put on some new glasses and look at The Greatest Showman in a way maybe that you're not used to looking at it. So here we go. Luke 16, 1 through 4. It says this: "He also said to his disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. So he called him and said, 'What is this I hear about you? Turn in the accounts of your management, for you no longer can be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I have a plan. I've decided what to do. When I'm removed from my management, people will receive me into their houses.'" We're going to pause there for a second. Now, this man must have been fired for a good reason. It says charges were brought to him that he was wasting possessions of his master. But nothing was ever said to indicate he was actually guilty of these charges. But we see here the man doesn't argue his case. So we can assume that he is actually guilty as charged. Now, this man apparently never worked physical labor, since he wasn't strong enough to dig. He also was too prideful to beg. But he thinks of a way, a plan, to have the people receive him into their houses, meaning that he wouldn't have to be homeless if this idea worked. What is this idea? We're about to jump in. 5-7. "So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and quickly write down 50. Then he said to another, 'How much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, 'Take your bill, quickly write down 80. We're going to pause there. He has this planned where he's calling in the debtors of the master, and he's asking them how much they owe, and he's cutting their bill. Maybe by cutting their bill, they will show him some grace. They will show him some mercy. This measure of that he's talking about here is no small amount of money. One measure of oil is equal to 875 gallons. One measure of wheat is between 1,000 and 1,200 barrels. So we're talking about some large sums of money here. There may have been some forgetfulness on this manager's part in collecting maybe these bills. Maybe that was part of the reason he was fired. We're not really sure. But he decides to cut these bills down. And you know what? It forces the master's debtors that owed him this money to pay up. Continuing on our story, Luke 16, 8 through 9. "The master commends the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings.' The master liked what he saw, so he commended him for being so shrewd." Shrewd means showing sharp or quick judgment. In fact, he was able to get them to pay at least some of the money. So I guess having some money paid rather than none is better than nothing, right? The master tells him here to make friends for yourself, not by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when they fail, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. What does this mean, right? This is kind of a crazy twist of the story. It means this: there's nothing inherently righteous about money. In fact, money is amoral. Money has no value, actually. Only the value that we put on it. And so I feel like Jesus is telling us in this parable that we are to use our money for the kingdom of God and His purposes. Maybe why we still have money, or maybe why we're still alive on this earth. Now, the verses we're about to read are why I believe Jesus is telling us that we must use our money, or even talents, or treasures, or things that God gives you, to bless others and to build God's kingdom up, because He entrusted us with this. He entrusted us to help these things we get, whether it's money, whether it's stuff or talents or treasures, to help others know God. And also the principle of this: not cheating our own masters or our employers out of what they deserve from us by the labor they give us. So listen to what it says here in Luke 16, 10 through 12. "One who is faithful with very little is also faithful in much, And one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If you've not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to the true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Jesus is talking about stewardship of our resources in these verses. That someone is faithful in the small amount, the Lord will entrust even more to them. That if we're dishonest in the small things, then we're going to be dishonest in the big things. If we're not faithful to what somebody else has gave us, how can we be faithful to what we have? God is never going to bless us if we cut. God is never going to bless us if we're not trusted in the small things. He's never going to bless us with the big things. We're going to be cut off from greater blessings in the future if we're not faithful in the small things today. Luke 16:13 finally says this: No servant can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one or love the other. He'll be devoted to one or despise the other. You can't serve both God and money. Your heart, your loyalty can't be divided in half. God can't work with half-hearted believers. He either has all your heart or money or what else, other things have the rest. And that takes the place of God as an idol. There's no way to serve two masters at the same time. And sadly, for some of us, we choose to serve God or we choose to serve something else, whether that's money or other things. Now, today's movie, we're going to look at some clips through this idea about people in the movie being fueled by or serving something other than what they should. This first idea I want us to look at is fueled by revenge. You see, P.T. Barnum's father-in-law didn't really think highly of P.T. He thought he would have not really amount to anything because he was the son of a tailor. P.T. was considered lower than him in society. So his father-in-law didn't treat him very well. And P.T. held on to this grudge throughout the movie. P.T.'s father-in-law even says that my daughter will come running back to the riches that I have. So in the movie, it's not really displayed greatly, but we get a sense of it in a few scenes. The first one being this, when P.T. buys a house, a big house down the street from his wife's parents. In that scene, we see his wife say and tell him this: Don't tell me you bought this house to rub my parents' noses in your success. And P.T. responds and says, Well, that's not the only reason I bought the house. You see, P.T. was fueled by revenge, fueled by this idea that he would amount to something, that he would be able to prove his father-in-law wrong. We're going to take a look at the second scene and watch. I want you to pay attention to how P.T. responds.
Miss Lynn, if you just give me a moment, I think...
Phineas, yes.
You've done well. Thank you. Allow me to introduce you. Excuse me, Jenny. Sorry. I'd like you to meet Charity's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Hallett.
Ah, pleasure.
How do you do?
Very nice. Nice to meet you. Mother.
Hello, dear.
Yes, yes, those are your granddaughters.
Phineas, not here.
Not here? You're afraid I'm going to embarrass your parents in front of their fancy friends? I really don't think I have that power. An insignificant man like me, who is clearly destined to lead an insignificant life.
All that fortune and still just the tailor's boy.
Get out.
Well, Phineas... I believe I told you that free champagne is a recipe for disaster.
Charity.
Now would everyone please raise
Charity.
Their glasses.
Did you catch how P.T. Barnum allowed the words of his father-in-law to fuel his revenge? I love that clip because you almost saw in the moment that he turned around, he didn't know who was there, and then once he realized it, did you catch that little grin? That little grin, I think, was that revenge, that idea that he had, that he probably shouldn't have acted on, but he did, right? How these words of the father-in-law ate at him and fueled this revenge. He disregards what his family or what his wife is telling him. And at the end there, she gets upset and leaves. and he's trying to call her back. You see, we can't serve the master of revenge and God. The next idea we're going to look at is this idea of fame and fortune. In a previous scene, we see P.T. talking with his friend. His friend that he convinced into helping him run the circus. Because, you know, P.T. Barnum, he wanted to appear and appeal to the higher class of people. And so he has this friend that he meets that is appearing and helping out with the higher class of people. So they've just met the Queen of England. They've just met a famous opera singer named Jenny Lind. And P.T. convinces her to come to America for this huge city tour. And in the clip we're about to watch, you see him talking to his wife. Now I want us to watch and pay attention to see how his family reacts and is affected by his decision to fuel his desire for fame and fortune.
First it was buying a house on the same street as my parents, then meeting the Queen, then bringing Jenny Lind and my father the other night. When will it ever be enough for you?
I'm doing this for Caroline and Helen.
Look around you. They have everything.
You don't understand.
I do understand.
No, you don't understand. How could you? My father was treated like dirt. I was treated like dirt. My children will not be.
You don't need everyone to love you, Finn. Just a few good people.
I know that.
Some people won't sail the sea, 'cause they're safer on land. To follow what's written, but I'd follow you to the great unknown. Off to a world we call our own. And all that will come in between. Desert and ocean, you pull me in, and together we're lost in a dream. Always in motion, so I risk it all just to be with you. And I risk it all.
I don't tear up very often, but movies get me. And the scene where he's leaving and his little girls are coming down and he still tells the horse or the chariot thing to go, I would be like bawling. I'd be like, no, I want to hug my kids one last time. I want to just to see the hurt on his kid's face, his wife's face. And even those that he befriended in the circus, you could tell that they missed him. Because he had this desire for fame and fortune. If you heard there, if you listened to the conversation between him and his wife, he says, I'm doing this for the girls. His wife said, look around, they have everything. He was fueled by this idea of fame and fortune because he didn't want them to grow up how he grew up. He didn't want them to be treated how they were treated. But then do you see how his wife at the end turned it back on him? His wife said, you don't need everyone to love you, just a few good people. You see, we can't serve the master of fame and fortune. and God. Our last idea we're going to look at is this idea of identity. And this idea is a very predominant theme throughout the movie. So much so, I was reading a lot of things this week, and three main messages from The Greatest Showman that somebody put out there, and a lot of different people put out there, but these are the three main messages that a lot of people agree on. It's this: be unapologetically proud of who you are, shine brightly and confidently. Second one is this: be open-minded, accepting of others, celebrate diversity. And the third one is this: control your own destiny, follow your heart, regardless of the world's hurdles and rules. Now, as we look at this next clip, this is a famous song, and there's going to be some music, but I want us to pay attention to the words of the song. Try not to get lost in the music and the singing, but the words. Listen to the words. And then we're going to look at this idea of identity and these three major themes.
I am not a stranger to the dark. Hide away, they say, because we don't want your broken parts. I learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, I'm gonna send the blood, gonna drown them out. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. So now, cause here I come, and I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen, I make no apologies. This is me.
Hard not to get lost and catching yourself either tapping your foot or singing during that. So I had to work very hard to not do that. And to really, I said, hey, I told them to listen to the words, so I need to listen to the words. So the three things we talked about are this: be unapologetically proud of who you are, shine brightly and confidently. I can get behind this idea because God made all people unique and purposefully. And you can take joy in his handiwork. We should let the light of Christ and the beauty of our God-given personality shine, working confidently in who God created you to be. Yet we also must recognize our sin, our fallenness, our need for God's grace to not only save us, but to sanctify us as well. The second idea on this idea of identity: be open-minded, accepting of others, celebrate diversity. This is another idea I can get behind. Unity among diversity is a biblical idea originating in the Trinity, in which three distinct persons are one God. And this is God's design for the church. Therefore, it's good to be accepting of others, to celebrate diversity. We look around, we're not all the same. I look at both of my kids, they are oppositely different. Yet, we cannot compromise truth. Sometimes we must call sin what it is and hold fast to that faith which is rooted in biblical truth. Now this third idea: control your own destiny, follow your heart, regardless of the world's hurdles and rules. This idea I cannot get behind. This idea I like to call the false gospel. The false gospel of the world. I think this is what the world wants you to believe. Follow your own destiny, follow your own heart, regardless of what other people are telling you, what other rules we have, what other hurdles are out there. This is an idea that is rooted in identity and following your own desire in your own heart. Jeremiah 17:9 says this, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" As Christians, we follow Scripture. We follow Jesus Christ, and we must submit to Him who controls our destiny, our wisdom, our goodness. Even when His Word, God's Word, contradicts our own desires and the way we feel. Emotions and desires are tools to be used by the Lord in our life, but they must not be the driving force. It's the true gospel where we find salvation and triumph by placing our hopes and our identity in Jesus Christ and what He has accomplished, not by following our own dreams. You see, we can't serve the identity of this world and God. I want to conclude today by saying this. Here's the kicker. When we serve money or we serve things and stuff, we become slaves to it. It says this, "You hold me in your hand and call me yours. Well, I call you mine. And see how easily I rule you, even though I am nothing. I don't hold the power to life. I'm meaningless without your stamp of approval. I go nowhere unless you send me. My power is terrific. I really am the master." And then on this other side, we have a call to love God. He's the real master, but His language is so different. Listen to His language. "I hold you in my hand," God says. "Even when you don't call me yours, I call you mine. I don't want to rule you. I want to save you, even though you are nothing. I hold the power of life, but I want to share it. I don't need your stamp of approval to be meaningful. I am everywhere. My power is terrific. I really am the master. And to make sure you know, I've sent my son to die for you." So in closing today, we're confronted by the Master who's asking a hard but ultimately simple question. What defines you? What defines you? Are you going to be defined by money, by fame, by fortune, or the identity of this world? And then you know what? The moment it's taken away, you discover that you are really nothing. Or are you going to be defined by God, to whom ultimately we come with nothing, but ultimately He gives us everything we need? What defines you? The choice is yours.
Additional downloads and resources are available by visiting flushingcommunity.org. Join us this Sunday as we gather to experience God's transforming love together.